What the F? My intent is to write about swearing, which is why my fingers are trembling above the keyboard. I know that at some point I'll have to type those four letters, the word I have such trouble saying even to myself. I'm sure you know what I'm referring to, but for now I will only say that it is an eviscerated fire truck. Several years ago, it was my New Year's resolution to swear more as a way to deal with frustration instead of breaking down in tears. I was tired of hearing my voice get pinched, and tired of the wary stare of strangers who realized that tears were imminent. It would happen even with the littlest things, like the local bank that sent me a revised receipt docking me $25 for a stack of checks that I had deposited after a holiday bazaar. Isn't it possible that there's a breach in your chain of evidence and a check went missing somewhere between this desk and the bowels of the home office in Chicago? I asked the bank manager. It seemed like a reasonable question. After all, I remembered that teller with the multicolored hair, garish fingernails, that teller with the black bra visible in the puckers between her overtaxed buttons. I watched her as she casually put my stack of checks into the drawer without benefit of a paperclip. I pressed ahead. What would happen if someone dropped the checks and they fluttered all over the floor? The bank manager did not flinch, and I revised my expectations. Restitution for a lousy $25 was no longer my goal. I just wanted some recognition that, similar to Monopoly, a bank can occasionally make an error. What is the point of a deposit receipt if the bank can arbitrarily change it? I asked. Again, a totally reasonable question, but I felt my throat tightening. The bank manager looked at me evenly. Perhaps you should have taken pictures of each individual check before you deposited them. That would be tangible proof, she said, tacitly admitting that the receipt I had carefully kept was worthless. Tears were brimming, and I knew that I had to leave before they started trickling. I gathered up my pathetic shreds of remaining dignity and stormed out. How much more cathartic if I could have let loose with a firestorm of obscenities, even if I just said a string of fire trucks to myself. But I've never been able to do it. My reticence is clearly based on my parents' sense of propriety. My father was a rule follower to the nth degree, whose primary goal was to remain a gentleman. Beneath his calm exterior, he must have had many provoking frustrations ripe for a cleansing rant. A mother who clearly favored his more charismatic older brother, who twice escaped from a German prison camp. An autistic son who would require lifelong care. Or a bright and boisterous wife, well-loved, but one who could cast a suffocating shadow across his more subtle charms. My father spent hours in the car each day commuting between suburbs and city, and I like to think they were filled with cathartic obscenities he picked up in his brief career as a Navy ensign at the end of World War II, or in his everyday work life as a salesman for a printing company. I don't think I ever heard him swear, other than the occasional cathartic damn or hell if he stubbed his toe. The only thing that even came close was a picture in his office of a bull poised above a little pile with a slash across it denoting no bullshit. In contrast, my mother was a rule breaker, but mostly in the name of irreverence for the pretensions of her affluent suburb. One of her favorite outfits was a dress with a diamond-shaped cutout above her modest cleavage. Before she went out, she would decorate the small expanse of flesh. She pasted in S&H green stamps, a spray of dog's hair, basically anything that was handy. My father would be horrified. However, my mother's irreverence did not extend to swearing. She had no qualms about damn or hell, and liked to make fun of the saccharine neighbor who could not even utter the mildest of swear words, instead relying on ding-dang-darn-it to express frustration. But the big red fire truck was clearly off limits. I don't think I ever heard her say it out loud. Oddly enough, occasionally she would use the word mother fire trucker, never in frustration or directed at a person, but only as an adjective to describe something memorable, basically a synonym for humdinger. That is one mother fire trucker of a bruise, she said when I showed her the legacy of a skiing mishap. Her best euphemism was the MFO, ostensibly describing a mandatory family obligation. However, if things went badly, the MFO could transition into a mother-effing ordeal. I decided it was time to find out what the experts thought, and was surprised to find a lively literature describing swearing and its cultural role across the centuries. A frequently referenced text is Ashley Montague's The Anatomy of Swearing, published in 1967. Even Mr. Montague is reticent. Using general terms, he discusses swearing and cursing in Shakespeare, followed by the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. Finally, towards the end of the book, there is a chapter titled Four-Letter Words. Mr. Montague is coy and refers to fire truck as the four-letter word, and then at last I sensed that he could go no further with the charade. The author took a deep breath and dove in. The paragraph was simply titled Peep. If Ashley Montague can do it even in the more tender sensibilities of the long-ago 1960s, maybe I can learn to let my guard down. The general themes of these books are the recognition of different categories of swearing and their roles in different social situations. It turns out that swearing is an umbrella term encompassing profanity, blasphemy, cursing oaths, and obscenity. According to Montague, profanity is, quote, the unsanctioned use of the names or attributes of the figures or objects of religious veneration, unquote. I.e., your basic, God damn it. Blasphemy may use the same words as profanity, but specifically criticizes religion itself. Cursing and oaths have religious origins and describe either a self-directed promise, i.e. an oath, or an outward-directed plea, i.e. curse, for a future evil event. Both of these categories can evoke all sorts of higher authorities, including religious figures such as God, Jesus, Merciful Father, all sorts of biblical characters or other authority figures such as royalty, or even one's own ancestors. The curse often describes a grisly death involving the sequential loss of different body parts. A plague on both your houses now seems like a quaint Shakespearean curse, but in the late 1500s such a fate could be terrifying for true believers. In today's terms, this curse could be equivalent to saying, I hope that you, your wife, your mother, father, and all your children contract a disfiguring antibiotic-resistant bacteria that slowly eats away all flesh, bones, sinews, and tender victuals. The church took a dim view of profanity, particularly blasphemy. After all, the third commandment says, Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain. And Leviticus 24 states, He that blasphemeth the name of the Lord shall be put to death. While the church's ban might have been an effective deterrent to the pious, outright prohibition often has the exact opposite effect. Besides, people began to realize that many curses were only empty threats, and as the dominance of the church waned, profanity and curses lost their taboo punch. Instead, swearing became an art form, with champions taking advantage of the vast menu of religious figures and grisly deaths that could be combined in any number of creative ways. Montague notes, quote, Catholic swearers are far more accomplished in the art than the votaries of other Christian sects, unquote. Psycholinguists, the niche group who specifically study the cultural impact of swearing, point out that once God, damn, hell, and their religious ilk were no longer taboo, new words were needed. The next frontier was obscenities, describing sex, anatomy, and the curious category of effluvia, i.e. piss and shit. Steven Pinker, author of the 2007 book, The Stuff of Thought, points out that there's nothing inherently obscene about these words. After all, everyone has to piss and shit on a regular basis, and it is just that our society has anointed these words as obscene. Scientists have probed the physiologic basis of swearing, investigating whether the urge to swear is always simmering within our gray matter, variably brought under control by social norms. Tourette's syndrome has served as a model. While the disorder is dominated by tics and twitches, occasionally sufferers will erupt in obscenities. Across cultures and languages, people with Tourette's use their own suite of taboo words. Pinker reports that a deaf person with Tourette's even spelled out the F word in American Sign Language. Research suggests that, across the board, swearing is an overpowering urge held in check by the brain's basal ganglia, a pair of structures that function as an internal sensor. Without this sensor, obscenities just come spewing out. The basal ganglia of Tourette's are lax, while mine had me twisted in a knot. By and large, I'm comfortable with effluvia, but I just cannot embrace the F-word, deemed the worst of them all. It is a word that's been around forever, perhaps derived from the Latin futere, to copulate, French foutre, again to copulate, or the German ficken, yes, to copulate again. The F-word has taken an interesting course since it appeared in the late Middle Ages, when it was used, as intended, as a verb. It is now morphed into every grammatical form, noun, adverb, participle, and the F-word has even been inserted into the middle of words. i.e. un-effing-believable, a phenomenon called infixing. The world wars were the great leveler, and the F-word in all its glory crossed class lines. Norman Mailer's World War II novel, The Naked and the Dead, was saturated with the F-word, and the publisher mandated the ludicrous substitution of the word fug. While originally used for abusive or cathartic intent, now the F-word can be used even in social settings. As the psycholinguists say, the F-word has lost its referential base. We can be thankful for that, considering the various anatomical impossibilities described by the word. Take a flying F and a rolling donut comes to mind. The word is now combined with profanity, such as Jesus effing Christ, an example of its common use as a mood intensifier. Sanitizing the word by using asterisks or bleeps on TV hardly disguises the word, and an incessant string of bleeps probably does more to convey high emotion than the word itself. The F-word may be following the same trajectory as damn and hell and is approaching the realm of polite conversation. However, I'm not quite there yet. My basal ganglia are still balking and will only consent to frigging or freaking euphemisms or those silly asterisks. Maybe I can retrain my sensors by focusing on casual social swearing and set aside angry cathartic swearing for now. I think of my parents and the small pig farm they bought when my father retired. They knew nothing about farming and relied on their neighbors at the end of the driveway, Phil and Marie. On weekends, my parents would work side by side with Phil in the pig barn as he told them what to shovel and where to put it. As shovels scraped and manure flew, Phil regaled my parents with a steady stream of the F-word in every grammatical contortion, admixed with a smattering of diverse effluvia. The performance was further embellished by syncopated splats of tobacco. My parents loved it. "Phil is the most marvelous swearer," my mother would enthuse. "You just can't believe what comes out of his mouth." Aside from Phil's wordsmithing, my parents appreciated the other role of social swearing, its sense of solidarity and common bond. Here is my father wearing a natty, cabled sweater and khaki pants, seeming a world away from Phil, who rarely strayed far from the farm and had never seen nearby Lake Michigan. My mother was not a shit shoveler, but she worked hard carting stones from the field to create a stone wall at the base of the farmhouse. Phil showed his respect by feeling totally comfortable in his profuse swearing in their company. This was a real coup for my mother, who hated pretension of any kind. Phil could also recalibrate his basal ganglia at a moment's notice. If my parents brought suburban friends or children to the farm, Phil's language would clean up instantly. This was further evidence of my parents' favored status. I was only an occasional visitor to the farm, and Phil never swore in my presence, which I regretted. I was tagged as an outsider. Perhaps he was waiting for a signal for me to let loose. If Phil offered me an iced tea on a hot day, maybe I should have casually said, "F yeah, Phil, that sounds great." In fact, maybe I'm a member of a cross-cultural diaspora of bottled-up vicarious swearers, all milling around waiting for the proper moment to either give or receive the go-ahead signal, the slight nod of the head, arched eyebrow, or sly smile. "F yeah" could be an ideal test phrase. Part of my interest in swearing is its creativity and its status as a linguistic art form. I think of the swearers of centuries past who could call on God and many other religious figures to produce a string of profanity that could run on for minutes. In his book, Montague quotes a Middle Ages curse by the Bishop of Rochester. It runs for about a page and a half and uses such phrases as, "May he or they be cursed in living, in dying, in eating, in drinking, in being hungry, in being thirsty, in fasting, in sleeping, in slumbering, in waking, walking, standing, sitting, lying, working, in resting, in pissing, in shitting, and bloodletting. May they be cursed in their eyebrows, in their cheeks, their jawbones, their veins, in their groin, in the thighs, and in the genitals." I can just imagine the indignant bishop standing with Bible in hand, working himself into a froth as he ticked off each body part in position. In contrast, our current cursing vocabulary is impoverished. The bishop's entire curse could be reduced to a simple F you. Aside from my mother's favorite mother F, basal ganglia still on high alert here, the F word does not lend itself to linguistic artistry. Swearing like the classic trooper, sailor, or even fishwife may now consist of the F-word with jackhammer intensity and frequency. Where's the creativity in that? In contrast, shit, my personal favorite obscenity, has generated wonderfully descriptive idioms. What could be more evocative than the expression, when the shit hits the fan, describing something that goes terribly, terribly wrong, or up shit creek without a paddle, perfectly capturing an utterly hopeless situation. The F word seems very pale in comparison. It just doesn't take much to sprinkle it thoroughly into a conversation. Who are those geniuses who came up with the great visual of shit, the fan, and the paddleless canoe? I would like to join their ranks as a wordsmith and come up with my very own original idiom. Then I could watch with pride as my creation, my bon mot, goes viral and shows up in the urban dictionary. Finally, based on its durability, my idiom could even end up in a dictionary of slang. I have worked on this for several weeks now and have only come up with tepid entries such as a shitless wonder. I have no idea what that means. Clearly, I set the bar too high. Time for plan B. I found Green's Dictionary of Slang at the library and started looking for a hidden gem that deserved wider play, one that would allow me to be the PR agent for a clever wordsmith. There were immediate problems in the 21 pages of entries for the F word. While I'm conceptually comfortable with the word as an ubiquitous intensifier, all the idioms derived from the F word reverted to their very explicit sexual nature. My inhibitory circuits raised a bevy of red flags, and my basal ganglia screamed, "No friggin' way, not on our watch!" The 20 pages of entries for shit were more promising, and I am proud to announce my selection. 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag. Perhaps not obscure to all, particularly those who work in a male-dominated environment where creative obscenities seem to thrive, but the expression is new to me and fits my must-have criterion of a strong visual image. Just pause a minute to let the visual sink in. The dictionary also provides references to books where the expression is used, suggesting a very peculiar job for the editor who combs the literature for new obscenities. According to the slang dictionary, the expression refers to an ugly woman, but I'm going to broaden its meaning to anything that is repulsive. Today is October 1st, 2013, and the government is shut down. I would like to say that the Republican Tea Party is nothing more than 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag. Fuck yeah. There, I said it out loud and even put it in print. My fingers are no longer trembling over the keyboard, and my basal ganglia have accepted the new normal.